Hello there, Ramona Koval here with The Book Show on ABC Radio National. Today we hear from Alexander Waugh, and you could say he's inherited the literary gene in spades. The English author is the son of journalist and satirist Auberon Waugh, the grandson of the novelist Evelyn, the grandnephew of writer Alec, and the great-grandson of the literary patriarch Arthur Waugh. But the heir apparent long resisted joining the family business. He tried his hand at record producing, composing music, working as a concert promoter, even drawing cartoons, before succumbing to what he does best. Alexander Waugh has written many best-selling and critically acclaimed books, including Time, God, and The House of Wittgenstein. But in his autobiographical Fathers and Sons, he gives an intimate blow-by-blow account of five generations of Waugh fathers and sons serving up one outrageous family story after another. Alexander Waugh was in Australia recently for the Melbourne Writers' Festival, where he spoke to critic Peter Craven about his family legacy. In this recorded interview, he begins by explaining why he wrote the book.
I started the book because my father died. I couldn't conceivably have written it while he was still alive. But a father's death, as many of you here will have experienced, triggers off a lot of things. In the case of the Waughs, there was a little bit of competitive tension and jealousy. That's to say, I was trying to write books. I was just starting off as a writer. And whatever I wrote, everybody wanted to compare it to Brideshead Revisited. I had an unpleasant episode when I wrote a book about God, which has been alluded to, and the Daily Telegraph said, I tell you what, we'll serialise it, we'll put great chunks of it in the newspaper, and that will be jolly, won't it? And I said, yes, that will be jolly. And then a week or so before the serialisation was due to start, some very moronic voice from the Telegraph went dring, dring, and I picked up the telephone. We've been having a think. How about, instead of we run some bits on your book on God, how about you write us an article about what your father and your grandfather would have thought about it? Red rag to a bull, I tell you. I was absolutely furious, and I said, it doesn't matter if you believe in God, whether you're an atheist or an agnostic or a theist. God is, whether you like it or not, the most influential figure in the history of human civilization. And surely he is more interesting than Auberon Waugh and Evelyn Waugh. And there was a ghastly silence down the other end of the telephone, and I realized I was wrong. So when my father died, I realized the only way to get rid of this, I won't call it a stigma, that sounds ungrateful, but to get rid of the issue, the problem, to sneeze out the phlegm, if you like, was to write a book about it. And then in future, if I wrote books about interesting subjects or subjects that interest me, such as God or the Wittgensteins, which I've recently done, and people said to me, what would your father or grandfather think of it? I do that pompous thing that the politicians do, which say, I refer you to the answer I gave a few moments ago. I refer you to the book that I wrote.
So, tell me about your great-grandfather. I was completely taken aback. I mean, I'd always associated Arthur Waugh with, I suppose, the portrait in Brideshead, and beyond that with John Gielgud's performance of his, I suppose, his comical dark side. But he sounds so besotted with your great-uncle Alec. Tell us about that.
Yeah, okay. Arthur Waugh, in a way, is the start of the story. Arthur Waugh is the father of Evelyn Waugh and Alec Waugh, and therefore my great-grandfather. He, let's say, by the end, was a very fat, very soft, very sentimental publisher. His father was a cruel, sadistic doctor from Somerset in the west of England and was known as the Brute. I have a few examples of the Brute's sadism. One of them, very peculiar, he used to wake up his son in the middle of the night, grab him out of his bedroom in his pajamas, and push him into a dark cupboard where he kept his guns, because the Brute loved shooting more than anything else, slam the door shut, and then shout through the door, "Kiss my gun case." to the little boy who just shivered and cried. He was set upon the gates and slammed and wriggled, and the brute used to creep up behind his son and fire off guns very, very loudly in his ear, ostensibly to fortify him and turn him into a strong, marvellous, sporty doctor like the brute was. This didn't work at all, and Arthur decided what he really wanted to do is go into literature. And so he said to his father, "I want to be in literature." And his father said, "That's pathetic, and no son of mine goes into anything as useless as that." But for once, flabby, soft, gentle Arthur was adamant. And we have a cousin who some of you may have heard of. He's actually a very distant cousin. And his name is, or was, Edmund Gosse. And Gosse, who died in 1928, was a very highly thought of literary figure in London circles. He was very close friends with Henry James, Thomas Hardy, all the Conan Doyle, you name them. And Gosse was a cousin. So in the end, the brute said to his son, "Okay, if you have to go into literature, ring up our cousin Gosse, go and see him in London, see what can be done." So he went and shivered at the table of Gosse with a lot of very famous writers there, and Gosse got him a job as a reader for Heinemann's. From there, Arthur Waugh went into publishing. He crawled his way up in publishing and became the managing director of a publishing company called Chapman and Hall, famous really for being the publishers of Dickens. And there's a beautiful irony which I will explain to you, but I think just to colour that irony, you have to understand that Arthur Waugh had two sons. Number one was Arthur, and 5 years later was Evelyn. And Arthur thought in his mind that he had missed the opportunity to be a great writer. Okay, he got himself into literature, he had published some poems, he actually published the first ever biography of Tennyson. But he wasn't a great writer and knew it, and wasn't bitter about that, but he decided to channel all the energy of great writerdom into his eldest son, Alec. And Alec, from the word go, was groomed to be a genius. From the age of six, he had acted Hamlet in a home production. He was encouraged to run a magazine, keep a diary. All the poems of Swinburne and all those frightfully boring poems were read to him. And Evelyn then came along 5 years later, and by the time he was five, Alec was already the genius. Arthur Waugh died in 1943, when Evelyn Waugh was already an extremely famous, highly respected, worldwide novelist. But by the time that Arthur died in 1943, he refused to accept that Alec was a lesser writer than Evelyn. And the point is that Evelyn clearly became a great writer to annoy his father. But what makes this irony, which I was going to tell you about, so particularly fierce and particularly amusing, is that when Arthur, for 30 years, was managing director of Chapman and Hall, his daily fear was what will happen when the copyrights of the Dickens run out. We don't really have a great authors list, and we're going to have to fall back on our science books. And in the run-up to the Dickens copyrights running out, Arthur Waugh edited edition after edition of Dickens, golden editions, because once they were the only people to have the complete set, they could still make a lot of money. And that fell, oddly enough, towards the end of 1927, the beginning of 1928. Evelyn Waugh hadn't written a novel. His brother was a famous novelist. He was very tense, and he needed to get married, and he was trying to marry a woman who was much more aristocratic than he was, because he wasn't aristocratic at all. And her mother was saying no to this awful lout. We don't want him. So he rushed off, and he scribbled out his first book, which was Decline and Fall. He sent it to a publisher called Duckworth, who said, this is dirty stuff, we're not publishing it. His father was on holiday. He very reluctantly took it to his father's firm, Chapman and Hall, and his father was contacted, and the father said, I don't want to know anything about it, you make the decision. The vote was passed by one vote, the board at Chapman and Hall, to publish Decline and Fall. Within, I would say, about 18 months, Decline and Fall was followed by a book called Vile Bodies, and Vile Bodies was selling 10,000 copies a week, and the terror the fear that Arthur Waugh had all his professional life, that Chapman and Hall would fail because of the end of the Dickens copyrights, was rescued by his younger son, whose books he didn't want to publish and whose books he thought were embarrassing, to say the least. Now, what makes this story even more poignant is that Evelyn Waugh filled those first two books and the subsequent book and the next book, and every book that went through Chapman and Hall had a joke against his father in it, and his father had to publish it. So that was pretty painful. Some of you might know the story of Mr. Loveday's Little Outing, a beautiful short story Evelyn Waugh wrote about a lunatic and a young lady full of hope and aspiration who goes to visit her father in the lunatic asylum and sees a very nice lunatic called Mr. Loveday and says, but he can't be a lunatic, he's such a nice man. He's so normal, he's so kind, so friendly. And she campaigns to get Mr. Loveday out. And Mr. Loveday eventually wins the case and he's allowed to go out. And 24 hours later, he's seen coming back to the lunatic asylum. What are you doing? Why are you coming back? I've had a perfectly nice day, thank you very much. And just up the road, there's a lady's bicycle and the lady has been strangled on it. Well, we're told in the story that Loveday had strangled a lady earlier, and that's why he was in the lunatic asylum. So he has a little outing, he does it again, comes back, he's perfectly happy. Well, Arthur Waugh was completely obsessed about women on bicycles. He taught them to ride bicycles in the street outside their house when Evelyn was growing up. He loved to watch their bottoms writhing on the bicycle seats. He wrote a whole poem called Legends of the Wheel, which is all about girls on bicycles. And he devoted four pages of his autobiography to, yeah, you've guessed it, girls on bicycles. And that's just one of the ways in which Evelyn made his father blush.
What a family. You're listening to The Book Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Ramona Koval, and you're listening to a recording of Alexander Waugh at the Melbourne Writers Festival last month. He's speaking with Peter Craven about his autobiographical book, Fathers and Sons. Here, Alexander talks about his granduncle, Alec Waugh, the author of Island in the Sun, and his rumoured homosexuality.
He was an erotomane. He went to bed with... He's one of those people who succeed in going to bed with a grandmother, the daughter, and the granddaughter, that sort of thing. And he was extremely candid about it, and he wrote a great deal about all the affairs he had had, which were very, very, very many, and wrote intimately about the sensations of... you all know what happens in the act. He wrote about it. And he said that certain ladies from Tahiti, for instance, have very good sort of pressure. And it's very disgusting, all this, isn't it? But I might point out that the wars tend to be pretty frank about these things. And actually, it all kicks off, this filthy side of things, if you remember the story, with a letter I dug out written in 1913 from Arthur Waugh to his absolutely beloved Alec Waugh about masturbation. And it's very good, actually. Should we talk about that, or is that too disgusting for Australians?
It's astonishing, this letter. The letter is written from a high moral standpoint, and if you're a person of middle years, you will get the faintest whiff of the perhaps of the pruderies of the 1950s or 60s or whatever, but spelt out with such kind of absolutely confessional detail that it takes your breath away.
But would you like a little bit from it?
Yes.
Funny enough, it's a beautiful letter and it goes on for pages and pages, and so I won't do it. I'll just cut a few little bits from it. But all boys at that age were taught that masturbation is something extremely wicked and bad and shameful. Alec did it. Funny enough, he did it, and this shows how honest my family are, because he admitted it. He was given a detention in the chapel and told to stay on his knees in the chapel all night long. And during that night, discovered himself. He felt extremely bad about it and went to his housemaster and told his housemaster what he had done. His housemaster, we're talking about 1913, okay? His housemaster wrote to his father, to Arthur Waugh, and wrote a letter that was so obscure and tangential that Arthur Waugh had to read it about four times to realise what it was talking about. Then Arthur Waugh thought he had got the point and wrote to his son. But I'll just read a tiny bit of it. It is quite natural that you should experience these temptations. Everyone does. As a boy emerges into a man, the sap, as it were, in his body rises, as with trees in spring, and these desires are the result. But nature affords a certain safety valve in what we used to call as boys wet dreams, when you lose a certain amount of sap or seed in the night. Now, if you are old enough to have had one of these dreams, you will know that in the morning you feel slack and weak after it, perhaps with a slight headache. That is because the seed comes from near the backbone, and the backbone is the thread of life. Every time seed is lost from the body, the backbone is slightly affected. But if one feels weaker after a natural loss, it follows that a forced loss of seed, such as self-abuse entails, is much more mischievous. It is indeed a deadly danger because it undermines the very seat of life. The result of self-abuse, if carried on persistently, is first weakness, both of body and mind, and finally paralysis and softening of the brain. This is absolutely true.
And we get letters of that degree of intimacy consistently from Arthur to Alec, don't we? I mean, not...
The letters between Arthur... This is a nice part of it. Every biographer gets a eureka moment. And I had signed the contract with the publishers saying, what I'll do is I'll give you a blow-by-blow intimate account of father and son relationships for five generations. But I didn't really know what I was going to find. And then I discovered in the archives of Boston University a pile of letters about this thick. But before I'd taken the string off them, there was a little note on the top in the spindly hand of my great-uncle Alec saying, I believe these letters to be some of the most extraordinary letters ever written from a father to a son. Well, for someone who's writing a book called Fathers and Sons about this particular line of fathers and sons, to be told that you're about to see some of the most extraordinary letters ever written from a father to a son was beyond belief exciting. What's extraordinary about them is not just that weird letter about masturbation, which I think it is interesting to find a letter like that from 1913, but the intensity of the relationship which develops in those letters. And we all have our little sound bites, do we not, about Evelyn Waugh and saying he was snobbish, he was rude, he was complicated, he was this, he was that. But I think without really understanding this bizarre background, being one of only two boys, 5 years younger, with the father devoting every second of his life and passion.
So, I mean, it's strange to think of such a great comic writer as Waugh being, in the deepest sense, the younger son, the emotionally disinherited figure. Do you think this played into his own kind of blackly comic presentation of his own children as kind of rabbits and idiots and what have you?
I think there was a very conscious and a very deliberate move on Evelyn's behalf when he went to university in 1922 to react against his father and become the opposite as much as he possibly could of his father. And his father was deeply sentimental, and Evelyn cultivated a reaction against it that was frighteningly unsentimental. What interested me about the book was that it was tracking the relationship, intimate relationship of fathers and sons over five generations. And I can say without boasting, because I just believe it to be the fact, that no other family in the world could produce this book, for the simple reason that no other family in the world has the archive. So on the one hand, while I accept that I don't think the wars are exceptional in the sense that every single family in the world is absolutely extraordinary, and every single family has its share of cranks, of highly talented people, of greedy and unpleasant people, and of their arguments. We all have it. We all have it. The only thing that makes the wars unique, and again, it's not the fact that they were all writers. And lots of families stick to the same professions, whether they're carpenters or miners or whatever it is. The only thing, in my view, that makes the wars unique was this archive. I suppose because they were all writers, there was just so much material. Evelyn Waugh detested the telephone, so he would always write rather than talk to anybody. Evelyn, his brother Alec, his father Arthur, my father, I mean, that's just a start. They all wrote autobiographies. They all wrote diaries. I've got at my house something in the region of 8,000 letters that Evelyn Waugh sent. It's what amazed me, really, is looking down the line, if you like, to what happened, how one father behaved in one way, and how did that affect the generation going down below. And with Evelyn Waugh, you see him reacting violently, as I said, against his father, being in every way the opposite of his father, and then turning into his father towards the end. And you see the beginning of that turn with Brideshead Revisited. Alec Waugh, the cosseted one, the loved one, the one who is brought up to be the centre of the whole family, he can't stay at home, he can't have a family. He wanders off, he travels, he ignores his children. Now, we're told that Evelyn Waugh was a really bad father. I contest this very strongly. He wrote extremely rude things about his children in his diary, saying they are intellectually useless, they have ugly voices, they irritate me. But come on, let's be honest, our children irritate us. That diary wasn't particularly designed for publication. In fact, it wasn't designed for publication. He wrote it usually when he was drunk in the evenings after dinner and went in there and said, "These are my day's irritations." Interesting, if you notice the difference between Evelyn Waugh's diaries and Evelyn Waugh's letters, the letters are wonderful, as I think everyone agrees. The diaries are curmudgeonly and aggressive. The reason for that is he wrote his letters in the morning when he was sober, and the diaries in the evening when he was drunk and usually in a bad mood. But in many ways, he put a huge effort into being a father. He really did, and he admitted that all his irritation with his own father had to be revised when he became a father himself.
Tell me a bit about your own father, Auberon. I mean, he comes across in the book, I suppose, as a kind of an inverted chosen son. I mean, it's amazing what a free spirit he is. There he is at, where was he, at Downside, wasn't he?
Downside, a Catholic school in
the very famous British Catholic public school, and it's not entirely clear that he didn't burn it down, is it?
It's not entirely clear, no. No, it did burn down, and he wrote a long letter to his father describing the burning with great relish and saying, "You may think it's me, but I think I might know who it is." He was a very, very funny man, but I never had a serious conversation with him in my life. But I would say that our relationship wasn't entirely frivolous. Actually, I did have one serious conversation with him in my life, and I'd like to tell you about it. I had a girlfriend at school, and the girlfriend decided I wasn't up to scratch, and she, what we in those days called, chucked me. And I was extremely cross about this, because I thought I was deeply in love with her. And I went home, and I was an adolescent, and I was very, very angry. And I thumped the table at dinner and said, "I never want anything to do with women again. I think they're treacherous, they're callous, and all they do is cause pain and misery, and I want no more women in my life." And my father said to me, "I would like a word with you in the library." Now, he had never, ever done this to me before in my life, and that was an odd headmasterly thing to do. And I went into the library, and as usual, he was working, always working, and he looked up, he looked at me, and he said, "The anus was designed for the retention and expulsion of fecal matter, not for the introduction of foreign organs, however lovingly placed." And I left the room in tears of laughter. And that was the only serious conversation he ever had with me. And he never disciplined me in any way at all.
Alexander Waugh speaking about his father, Auberon, at the Melbourne Writers' Festival last month. You're on The Book Show with me, Ramona Koval, and you're listening to a recording of Alexander Waugh speaking with Peter Craven at the Melbourne Writers' Festival. The book is Fathers and Sons, and here Alexander talks about the more sombre chapters.
My father died about 7 years ago, age 61. He had on his back, if you were ever privy to seeing his back, he had a long scar about so long, and I suppose it was about that deep in its deepest part, running right the way down the back to his shoulder, and he was missing a finger on his left side, and he had a lung that had been removed, which of course you couldn't see, but I was informed that there was only one in there. And this all happened when he was doing his military service. He had a choice. He could go to Oxford University and then do his military service, or go to military service first and get it over and done with. he took the wrong choice because he decided to get the military service over and done with. Had he gone to Oxford, military service would have been banned by then. It wouldn't have happened. His version of the story, which I suspect is a lie, was that he was trying to mend a machine gun that was stacked up on a tank, and he wriggled it, and it blew off at him. I suspect it's a lie because that doesn't sound right, does it? Machine guns don't just go off. I think the lie was an honourable lie. My guess of what was happening is he was asking about with his men that there was another man behind the gun and possibly that the trigger jammed and he was being foolish and standing in front of it. Anyway, he lay there dying on a very, very hot road in the summer, and this all took place in Cyprus, was rushed to a hospital in Nicosia, and Evelyn Waugh was contacted. But Evelyn did not, and this is one of the things I couldn't understand in Evelyn's motivation, he didn't think it was necessary to go out to Cyprus to see his son, even though his son was very, very likely to die. The most moving aspect of the whole book for me was when I came across a letter that was buried in a trunk. The letter had been written by my father to his father, who hadn't visited him. And it was, and we're all told what a ghastly father Evelyn Waugh was, but I mean, this letter said, "Dear Papa, I love you more than any other man, and I respect you and admire you." And it really makes me sad to even talk about it now. But, and then in the end, what my father did was to send it to his bank. And on the back of the envelope, it says, "Will you pass this on to my father in the event of my death?" Evelyn Waugh, this all happened in 1958. My father actually survived, and Evelyn Waugh died in 1966, at which point the bank, noticing that Evelyn Waugh was dead, passed the letter back to my father, who, I think out of embarrassment, just shoved it to the bottom of this trunk and didn't mention it in his autobiography or anything. And I found it there. And I must say, I'm a man, and I'm a British man, but by George, I came very close to weeping when I read that. Yes, there's too much bloody stiff upper lip with the English, but one does worry about it a little bit. I've tried to be extremely honest with my children and open and tell them everything, and I've no doubt I'm turning them into psychopaths as a consequence.
I mean, it's strange. It's strange to read this. This extraordinary family history, because there's such absolutely unbuttoned and savage comic sparkle, and then there's so much stoicism in the face of human pain, and so much that isn't being directly expressed.
I think what works so well about the story and about that book is, and in this sense, I can't take this wonderful Boswellian credit. What makes it really good is the fact that because they were all writers, you can hear their own voices in there. I mean, it was a massive cut and paste job. I subsequently wrote a book about the Wittgensteins, and found that they had written lots of letters, but their letters were quite boring. You don't really get a feeling of who these people are through their letters much. They're passing information. Whereas the Waughs were really good letter writers, and you can get them to tell the story so much in their own words. In fact, in the English edition, it was called Fathers and Sons, The Autobiography of a Family, because that really was the point, that they were so able to tell the story themselves. And I think that got the reader very close to all of those people, and despite the fact that they might be British, they might be eccentric, they might be for some odd class or whatever it is, I think the reader will feel close to all of them in a strange way.
I mean, everyone, all the central characters in this book are intensely sympathetic. The Evelyn's father with his hopeless romanticism about his son, the feeling comes across as absolutely real. And then you get the older brother, Alec, the hack writer, golden boy, who, in the midst of everything else, the erotomania, whatever you want to call it, recognised from the start the genius of Evelyn.
Wasn't that wonderful of him? Yes. Evelyn, in 1955, Evelyn sued the Sunday Express for saying that he, Evelyn, was very jealous of his brother, and his brother sold far more books and was a popular writer and much more successful than Evelyn. And Alec travelled all the way from Tangier, where he was living, to stand up in court and say, "This is absolute rubbish. My brother is a far greater writer than I will ever be. And he sells far more books, and I'm absolutely pathetic little tiny worm in comparison." And he was very loyal in that sense. And he always used to say, you know, that having this really great brother, younger brother, this great writer, all it does is it lifts the name of War on the literary bourse, is the way he used to put it. And it was very touching that, you know, having been groomed to be the great one, being the older brother, having taught Evelyn, in a sense, everything he knew and been the big boy, that he was prepared to take a back seat and take a big bow in honour of his younger brother.
A.N. Wilson said at the time of your father Auberon's death that, well, I think he actually said, which probably wasn't the most felicitous phrase, that Auberon was a more important writer than Evelyn, which I suppose was deliberately leading with his chin, but he certainly highlighted what was obvious to anyone who read your father's journalism, apart from anything else, that it was immensely distinguished stuff, and more distinguished than it looked because it was so funny.
It was very, very funny.
The funniness disguised the.
My father was a very interesting man, you know, because my father could lay down these very strong opinions, be very clever and at the same time quite babyish, and there's no real sense of himself pushing himself forward. That's a real art, I think, in essay writing, and I think he should be rated very, very, very highly for that. As to the word important, I think it's a babyish word, and I know he would have thought it babyish. In fact, my father's life was spent throwing rotten tomatoes at the concept of importance. So he wouldn't have liked to be called more important than his father or less important, and I don't think they were. I think what the wars seems to have done of writers, if you look down, is actually side-skirted the area in which their father would have dominated. I mean, my father did try and write novels, but gave them up quite quickly. And actually, I think you can see in the last novels he wrote when he was a young man, you see the journalist struggling to get out. I do think my father was a far better journalist than Evelyn Waugh. I think Evelyn Waugh's tone is a little bit arch when he writes his journalism. And again, back to the ego thing, I think you get the sense with Evelyn's journalism, as with a lot of journalists today, I'm Evelyn Waugh, I'm a very famous man, and now I'm going to tell you my opinion. You never get that sort of grandstanding from my father. So because he was such a good, brilliant journalist, I felt I couldn't really follow in those shoes. And so I ended up writing books that I don't think Evelyn or he would have written as well. So we've all just had to sideskirt. The only area I think we haven't covered properly now is plays. I look to my son.
Your son's going to be a man of the theatre, you think?
Well, that's about the last area left, because otherwise it's going to be too cringing. I was very brave of Martin Amis to battle on and take on his father in that way, writing novels.
Mm. Tell me about the Catholicism and the way in which that that torch was handed on and
extinguished, I'm glad to say.
Yeah.
yes. Well, Evelyn, as is known, converted to Catholicism in 1930 after the collapse of his first marriage. He went to church and did all the things that Catholic people do, but he didn't become strongly Catholic in his work until after the Second World War, and with Brideshead was the first one. And then Catholicism, in one way or another, threads itself as a theme through his books. And then I wrote a book about God, and I told my father I'd gotten quite a nice advance to write a biography of God. And my father's instant reaction, he went to his pocket and said, "How much are they giving you? I'll give you twice as much not to write it."
Do you think he was finally scared of offending somebody?
I've never quite understood his position. I don't think he was religious. I think he disliked religion, actually, but I think he believed in God very strongly and very personally. So it wasn't something he particularly felt he wanted to. His relationship with God was not something he felt he ought to talk about. I think he was, like his father, very disillusioned by the Catholic Church and irritated by it. He said once, if people ask me, do I believe in Jesus? He says, well, sometimes I'm thinking of an actress or reading the paper or doing something else.
Do you think, apropos of your grandfather's work, do you think the later work like Brideshead or Sword of Honour, do you think it's flawed by the Catholicism or enriched by it?
Definitely not flawed by it. These books are very, very rich in the themes and the ideas that run through them and the characters that are in them. And Brideshead, which he wrote in 1944, is the closest he ever comes to proselytizing. And many people have read Brideshead without being totally sure whether Charles Ryder actually converted in the end or not. So even that, and that is his the closest he came to proselytizing, that is very subtly done. And I am not afraid to say I'm of an atheist bent. I read Brideshead, and I'm always slightly ready to bridle if anyone pushes anything too Catholic at me, and I read it with huge happiness and interest because it's got so much stuff in it.
And the later war does get a kind of a tragic resonance from the Catholicism, doesn't it?
I think there's a lot of tragedy going on. He was absolutely pissed off with the Catholic Church by the end. He didn't like the reforms of the Vatican reforms. He believed that the world was being taken over by the barbarians who had got through the gate, caused largely by the war and the disruptions of the wars. And he just felt, towards the end, he signed all these contracts to write books that he suddenly realized he didn't really have the time or the inclination, didn't want to write them. He drank too much. He had very low blood sugar levels. He took a lot of sleeping pills and mixed them all up with creme de menthe and bromide. And he was an adventurer. You have to remember about Evelyn Waugh, all that early part of his life, he was going up the Amazon single-handedly. He was going around in Africa. He was always traveling, always adventuring, just like all those writers and Hemingway and people like that. And he lived for adventure, which he then put into his books. And the war for him was the last big adventure. And I think he felt thereafter, and you see the photographs of the thin, bright-eyed Evelyn Waugh, and then that rather paunchy, jacketed, squire-looking Evelyn Waugh, the post-war Evelyn Waugh, and that was the onset of this big depression. The adventures were over, and now it was just being a famous writer, having a family, and trying to keep the show on the road.
And now, if you could show your appreciation to...
Thank you. Thank you.
Being appreciated there is Alexander Waugh speaking with Peter Craven at the Melbourne Writers' Festival last month. The book is Fathers and Sons. It's published by Holder Headline. And Alexander is currently working on a book about another interesting family, the Freuds. And that's the end of the book show today. But on Monday's program, book banning in the United States. Last year, there were calls for 513 books to be taken off the shelves, mostly because they were deemed offensive to children. Well, the American Library Association has for the past 27 years been holding Banned Book Week to highlight that censorship is still alive and kicking in the US. And it's doing so again this month. So we'll find out on Monday what books are on this year's hit list and why. Thanks to the book show's producers, Linda Lepresti, Sarah Lestrange, Erica Voles, Kate Piercy, Verica Jokic, and technical producer, Angie Grant. Remember, you can hear this program again tonight at 7 o'clock, or if you're listening to in the evening, you can go to the website to hear it again, abc.net.au/rn/bookshow. That's where you can download the program as a podcast and find today's guest and book details there too. Ramona Koval here on ABC Radio National.
The sports governing body has ordered Semenya to undergo physical tests to prove she's not a man.
Caster Semenya is not the first woman athlete to have her gender questioned.
The International Amateur Athletic Federation introduced an inspection test. 243 female athletes all paraded in front of three doctors in the nude, apart from holding their passports.
The story of sport, gender and the Cold War. That's Rear Vision. You can download this program from the Radio National website.